I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
This is Buried Truths. I'm Hank Klibanoff. In recent years, as the audience for Buried Truths has grown, I've been asked how I got started on these civil rights cold cases. Well, for reasons I'm about to explain, this seems like a perfect time to go into that. I've been teaching the Georgia Civil Rights Cold Cases class at Emory University since 2011, when Professor Brett Gadsden and I organized it. The departments of History, African American Studies, American Studies, and Creative Writing all cross-listed it, and the deans gave their blessing to this unique way of teaching history. In that decade, I've taught 175 undergraduate students. But I'd actually started working on these civil rights cold cases earlier in 2008, when the director of the Center for Investigative Reporting, Robert Rosenthal, asked me to work with journalists who were digging into cases of unpunished racially motivated murders in the South. Now, why do I mention this? Because some of the work I was fortunate to have had a small hand in back then is about to be featured in a PBS Frontline documentary called American Reckoning.
Yeah, get that phone, somebody. What is happening is that the people are arming themselves, true, but tonight people just want to serve notice on the city, that's all. We just gonna let these people know we tired. We have a mass meeting tonight, Friday, August 27, 1965, place, Nice and Catherine.
This documentary, set in the 1960s in Natchez, Mississippi, and in small Louisiana towns on the other side of the Mississippi River, tells the story of a small but vicious cell of the Ku Klux Klan, the Silver Dollar Group. Now, the Silver Dollar Group served for years as a constant threat to black people in that area. You'll hear, in American Reckoning, the little-known account of black men and women in Natchez, Bogalusa, Louisiana, and the towns in between, who finally drew the line against white violence. You'll hear the story of how some armed themselves as the Deacons for Defense and challenged white supremacist control. Importantly, and sadly, you'll see the story of a good man, husband, and father, Warless Jackson Sr., who was working at the Armstrong Tire Plant in Natchez in 1967. He was doing a good job and was offered a promotion to the Chemical Mixing Division, where his work hours would change from nights to days, and he would get a pay raise. But his wife, Ex-Erlina, a woman wise in the ways of the Jim Crow South, urged Warless to turn down the job. Why? White men at the plant wanted that job, she told him, and they'd never forgive a black man for taking what they thought was rightfully theirs. Warless countered that the pay raise, while only pennies per hour, would enable her to leave her job as a cook in the black schools. She could spend more time at home with their children. He took the promotion. Weeks later, he worked a little overtime, left work, he got in his baby blue pickup truck, and he drove home. As he neared his neighborhood, he pressed down on his turn signal, and he triggered a massive bomb underneath his seat.
Nearly 1,000 Negroes are marching silently through the center of Natchez, protesting the bomb-slaying Monday night of civil rights leader, father of five, Wallace Jackson.
In this documentary, American Reckoning, you'll get to meet Stanley Nelson, who for many years was editor of a small weekly newspaper, the Concordia Sentinel. It circulated in Concordia Parish in the towns of Faraday and Vidalia, Louisiana, which is on the Mississippi River. On the other side of the river is Natchez, Mississippi. Now, most of what is known now about the Silver Dollar Group and the Deacons for Defense is because of Stanley Nelson's dogged daily and nightly investigative reporting into the gruesome killings of three black men, Warless Jackson Sr., Frank Morris, and Joette Edwards, as well as others. Stanley's work was greatly supplemented by two law professors at Syracuse University, Paula Johnson and Janice McDonald, whose pursuit of records held by the federal government produced 10,000 pages on the Warless Jackson case alone. Now, we'll come back to Stanley Nelson in a bit. First, let me introduce you to the co-directors of American Reckoning, Brad Lichtenstein and Yoruba Richin. First, Brad tells us what the documentary is about.
Well, American Reckoning is the story of Warless Jackson Sr., who was murdered by a group of Klan members who called themselves the Silver Dollar Group. But it's really a bigger story than that, because we don't just tell the story of the murder and the investigative part of that, but we also really tell the story of a movement in Natchez, Mississippi. And we tell the story of a group called the Deacons for Defense, which is a black armed resistance group that provided security, safety for protesters and defended their community.
Meanwhile, Yoruba Richin, the other co-director, says Brad first told her of this project at the Sundance Film Festival, and she was quickly on board, especially when she learned about one key detail.
Reading the treatment and understanding more about the story, I found out or discovered that the Deacons for Defense were a part of this story. And that sealed the deal for me. I had heard of the Deacons. I discovered the Deacons a few years before and been a bit obsessed with them and about why, you know, I did not know this history or that it was history that was not widely told in terms of the Black freedom struggle. So that was really, you know, that was the, what, as I said, what sealed the deal for me in joining Brad as a co-director and, you know, and we didn't look back.
The film is not solely about the death of Warless Jackson Sr. It's about how a community pulled together, how Charles Evers took up the work in this community after his brother, Medgar Evers, was assassinated. And it's also about how a black community demanded change and got it. But there's more to the story, as Yoruba Richin tells us.
You know, like so much of our history, African-American history, you know, it's not just one strategy that works. It's different strategies, you know, and different strategies that work together that brings about change.
And I was just going to mention too that, you know, one of the things that we feel like we are trying to do with the film is to disrupt this narrative that nonviolence was the only or the dominant technique used to advance the freedom struggle. There's actually a long, long history of armed resistance when you look at it. And that this was the case in Natchez and it was the case in a lot of places. And also, you know, the Deacons were smart and they understood that if they could create a kind of mystique around themselves too, they could have an effect in pushing back against the violence from the Klan. And one of the leaders in our film says that at one point it wasn't but five of them. But it was enough that you can see the footage in the film, actually, that the leaders of the Klan at Klan rallies were expressing genuine fear of the Deacons and their retaliation.
And I want to tell you that one of the real gems in this documentary is rare footage taken over a 10-week period in 1965 when filmmakers Ed Pincus and David Newman documented efforts to organize and register black voters. One segment of that film, found at the Amistad Research Center at Tulane University in New Orleans, shows a group of black men swearing their allegiance to their community and to their movements for equality and self-defense.
Repeat your name.
Willis Jackson.
Willis Jackson. Yes. I do solemn swear upon my own free will, according that I will not,
reveal
or invade.
Now, when Brad Lichtenstein and Yoruba Richin saw that footage, very little of which had ever been aired in the past, they were astonished.
You can imagine how excited we were when Yoruba and I were looking at the footage, and we saw Willis Jackson Sr., our guy, walk into the room during that swearing-in ceremony and then be directly addressed and then take an oath. It was, from a filmmaker's perspective, it was a little miracle.
That was Brad Lichtenstein. He, along with Yoruba Richin, are co-directors of the documentary American Reckoning. It will premiere on Frontline from PBS on February 15th, 2022. Coming up, my conversation with the journalist who brought so much of this story to light and who was also featured in the documentary. That's in a moment. This is Buried Truths. I'm Hank Klibanoff.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
This is Buried Truths. I'm Hank Klibanoff. Stanley Nelson is the journalist I'd mentioned earlier who helped uncover the details behind the civil rights cold case murder of Willis Jackson Sr. He's a man I've known for quite some time. It was back in 2008 or so, over many months, a few years, and hundreds of hours on the telephone, that Stanley and I bonded. Stanley Nelson has described his search for the killers of Willis Jackson Sr., Frank Morris, and Joe Edwards as a manhunt. It consumed his life. At the same time, as editor of the Concordia Sentinel newspaper with an entire staff of only three people, he had so many other obligations. He covered the police, the courts, the drainage commission, politics, government, you name it. And if that doesn't give you a clear picture of the life of a weekly newspaper editor, there's this. Stanley also wrote the local history column about Jim Bowie's rather famous sandbar fight in 1827, the tornado of 1840 that killed 300 people down there, the cholera outbreak 9 years later. The area's notorious past was also good fodder: gambling, prostitution, corruption, and the historic Klan infestation of law enforcement. Also very popular with the readers were Stanley's stories about three local heroes, all first cousins. I'm speaking of television evangelist Jimmy Swaggart, whose church defrocked him after he was found to be consorting with prostitutes. Another was Mickey Gilley, the country music singer and songwriter, and owner of the Texas Honky Tonk, featured in Urban Cowboy. And the most famous of these first cousins, Jerry Lee Lewis, the killer, who as a kid sharpened his own wild piano performances by sneaking into a black juke joint named Haney's Big House in Faraday to see how the early rhythm and blues rockers drove crowds crazy. I began by asking Stanley how he got on this path of investigating civil rights cold cases.
Well, in 2007, in February, one morning, a Wednesday morning, my boss at the Sentinel, Leslie Captopon, walked into my office and she said she heard the FBI was going to reopen or take another look at some old civil rights era cold cases. And she said there was a Faraday man on the list. So I immediately called the Southern Poverty Law Center, and they had some information on Frank Morris that a woman named Penny Weaver, never will forget her, because as soon as I hung up the phone, She faxed me about 150 heavily redacted pages that they had gathered from the FBI on the Frank Morris case. And I wrote my first story. It was about 150 words. And it simply said that Frank Morris was who had for many years owned a shoe shop in Faherty, that one night in 1964 in December after midnight, that some men come to the shop and set it on fire while he was inside. And he was severely burned and died 4 days later. Well, I thought to myself, I had never heard of Frank Morris. And so I was thinking, that is crazy that I'm the editor of the newspaper, and I don't even know, had never heard the name Frank Morris. And about just a few days later, I got a phone call from Frank Morris's granddaughter, Rosa Williams, who was 12 at the time her grandfather was murdered, and had, as an adult, moved out of state to Nevada. Someone had sent her a copy of the Concordia Sentinel, and she had read the article and called me, and she told me that she had learned more in that one article than she had ever learned in her whole life, in all of the years between seeing that article and when her grandfather had been killed. And Rosa touched me because I never saw or thought about those kind of things until I heard that from her. And then I recall that when I was young, we came upon the site on highway one night of a terrible traffic accident in which this young family, this man and his wife and their six-year-old daughter, were their Volkswagen Beetle had been hit by a driver who was intoxicated, and that Volkswagen exploded into flames, and they burned up in that car, and we saw part of that, and it was horrific. And I could not get out of my head, how do you purposely set somebody on fire, which is what had happened to Frank Morris. And so that's when sort of I decided, and I talked to the owners of the Sentinel, and they agreed that I was just going to start writing stories about whatever I could find out. And Frank Morris was the first year or so that was predominantly what I wrote about. And what I would do was, for instance, somebody would tell me that Frank was brought to the Concordia Parish Hospital, and these were the possible nurses that may have tended to him at that time. And after a while, I found the nurse, and then I would find these other people. And then while I was doing this, I began to learn about Joseph Edwards, who had gone missing 6 months before Frank Morris had been killed. And then I learned that 3 years after that, this man named Wallace Jackson, involved in the NAACP in Natchez, had been bombed and killed in 1967. And just ended up having these 8 cases that I was particularly interested in. But it began to be just one thing would lead to the other. And then it got to where just like my phone was ringing all the time.
You uncovered so many amazing stories, and probably something that 10 minutes before your boss came through and said, say, did you see what's in the news about a guy who was killed here some years ago? You would never have had any idea you're going to end up on these kinds of stories, right?
Absolutely no idea. And that was one reason I was so grateful when the Center for Investigative Reporting put me together with you and the other reporters, because it was helpful for me. One worry I had early on, race is such a polarizing issue. And there we are in the Deep South where these crimes had committed. And, black people get upset, white people get upset, thinking everybody's going to call them a racist and indict us for all of this. And, you get all of these complicated issues. So my thought was, the one thing that I can do that I think might help is if I can just write about who Frank Morris was and what he meant to the people in the community of Faherty, what he contributed, all the young black men that he gave their first jobs to, all of the very nice white women who would drive their cars up to his shop. And Frank Morris was a very smart man. He knew the era in which he lived, and he knew the line that he had to negotiate in operating within both the black and white community. And he would go out and pick up shoes to repair or from the white women that would drove up. Most would not go inside the shop. That would have been, although some did, most did not. And because of that, thing about Frank Morris was this white women issue. 6 months earlier, Joseph Edwards had gone missing. He was a 20-something year old, worked at a motel in Vidalia. And he, the issue that happened with him was he had been flirting with white women, had been doing it, had actually may have planted a kiss on a white woman that drew the ire of her boyfriend. And his friends were telling him, you're being really reckless with your life at this juncture in 1964. You could be killed. But Joseph Edwards just did not have any fear about that. So he ended up going missing. So 6 months later, when Frank Morris is killed, there's this rumor that Frank is allowing white women to come in his shoe shop at night and they're having sex with black men. And also that Frank is basically a pimp. And so when I started talking to people in Faraday 50 years later, this is the motive for the crime I kept hearing was Frank was doing this stuff at night. But as I began to talk to people, I found more and more questions over whether there was even an ounce of truth to that. And I never will forget one day I got a phone call from this 85-year-old white woman. Back in my office at that time, I didn't have caller ID, so I couldn't identify who she was, and she wouldn't tell me her name. But she said to me, she said, "Mr. Nelson, I've been reading those articles about Frank Morris and the white women." She says, "You know, I would go to the shop really once a week or every other week with something, shoes. I had three or four boys, and they would be with me." And said he was just the nicest man. Always took my orders. Never said anything crude or rude in any kind of way. And she says, "I just think it's terrible that he's being portrayed that way." And I said, "Well, ma'am, I think you're right." So I kept working on that. And finally, I found an FBI agent named John Pfeiffer. And after about a year, he began to open up to me, and we began to really talk about these cases. He had worked in Concordia Parish for 10 years. And he said, "I brought up the motive for Frank Morris's death concerning the alleged white women issue." And he sort of chuckled a little bit. He says, "Oh, yeah." I said, "I spent a lot of time on that." He says, "And I can tell you that's absolutely not true." I said, "Well, who started that?" And he says, "Well, it was Frank DeLauder, this Deputy Sheriff Frank DeLauder." So what's the purpose of the rumor? Why that rumor? Well, first of all, in the white community, people would say, they would think, "You know, I like Frank Morris, and it's terrible. It's absolutely terrible what happened to him. He get burned up in his own shoe shop. But Frank ought to know better than having done something like that. He should have known that would get him in trouble." As if, even if he had done that, which he had not, it would be a good excuse for somebody to come and kill him the way they did. We had an opportunity to set the record straight in many of these cases on what was true and what was not true, what was a Klan rumor. And we're also, I hope, able to free Frank Morris's good name from being this, basically this pimp who didn't care anything about women or about people. And, you know, that was a satisfying thing for me.
Let's talk about Warless Jackson, since that is the centerpiece of the documentary American Reckoning. Tell us, if you would, Stanley, who Warless Jackson was and why he is significant in this context.
Well, Warless Jackson was a native of Florida, and he had connections with Natchez. In fact, he lived in Natchez a while. He went and served in the Korean War and went back finished his military career. He was in Chicago, I believe, is where he served his last few hours of time in the military. And there he met Ursulina Williams, who was a native of Natchez who had moved to Chicago. Well, they fell in love, got married, and moved back to Natchez. And Ursulina's mother still lived in Natchez, and they started a family. And in the mid-1950s, Orlis Jackson got a job at the Armstrong Tire Plant in Natchez. As time passed, they ended up having several children, one son, the rest of them daughters. Jackson was a real family man, liked to hunt and fish, raised hogs, did everything he could to support his family. He got to know a man named George Metcalf, who also worked at the tire plant. And together, the two men joined the reorganized NAACP in Natchez in 1965. Metcalf was elected president, and Wallace Jackson was elected treasurer. And about 6 months after Metcalf and Jackson had been elected to their post, well, they had spent their time pushing for desegregation of the schools and other things like that within the community. They made demands to the city to hire black people, to open up the restaurants, to enforce the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act. And so in 65, the NAACP, led by Metcalf, filed a lawsuit to desegregate the Natchez school system. And in August, just a few days after he filed that suit, his car was bombed by a group of Klansmen known as the Silver Dollar Group. He survived. And for a year, he recovered. When he went back to work, Warless sort of took upon himself to drive him to work every day and sort of be his bodyguard.
And as you say, in all the work that you did, and it comes out a little bit in the documentary, there were clans within clans within clans, and the Silver Dollar Group was well known to be the most violent of them all. But tell us about them, if you don't mind.
I'll tell you the truth. Some of these Klansmen, some of these Silver Dollar Group guys, you know, they lived in a world, we still see it, of conspiracy. Of the government's going to take over everything. They're going to make us live with black families. They're going to make my white daughter marry a black, you know, all of these crazy ideas. They were anti-immigrant. They were anti-Catholic. They just were ignorant men. They didn't read. The things that they did read would be inflammatory type things, you know, you can just imagine the type of stuff that they were interested in, and they were ignorant of these type of things. They feared competition with black men like Wallace Jackson because they feared, I believe, that they might be smarter than them or more qualified than them.
And as Stanley Nelson tells us, the Silver Dollar Group in no way liked the fact that Wallace Jackson was about to land that promotion I was telling you about at Armstrong Tire, a job that more than likely would have gone to a white man. Incidentally, the account that's coming up is very graphic, and frankly, it might not be suitable for younger children.
In late 66, early 67, came word that they were going to hire a new person in the position of chemical mixer at the plant because their production was being increased. And the job would enable Orlis Jackson's wife, Ursulina, to not have to work anymore. She was suffering from lupus. And so it was sort of a victory for the family. But Ursulina did not want him to take that job. She didn't even like the fact that he was driving Metcalf to work and being his bodyguard because she said, Metcalf's been a target once, Orlis, you may be the next target. But he wouldn't hear of that. And she also would say, and you know, you've got five children, and his child is grown. Wallace got that job. He was one of 122 people that applied, the only black man. He had the most seniority and the most experience, and he got the job. And this day in late February of 1967, it's raining. Jackson was supposed to get off work at 4 o'clock, but they were heavy into production. They had some quotas to fill. So Jackson and a white man who had a similar job agreed to work overtime. Jackson worked 4 hours overtime. At 8:01, he left the plant got into his pickup truck, drove a couple of blocks, and when he turned on his left blinker, that truck exploded, blew apart, threw Jackson out of the truck on the ground, and he was dead instantly. Ursulina was at home laying in bed just a few blocks away. She heard the explosion. She just shouted out, "Oh, Lord, that's Jackson. They done got Jackson." She called him by his, she always affectionately called him by his last name. And sure enough, that's exactly what had happened.
So the explosion, somebody else heard that explosion, their son, Warless Jr., right?
It was that next day, I believe, when the FBI had come. They flew in two experts from Washington overnight who had bomb experience. And while they were up there that next morning, Warless Jr. got on his bicycle and rode up to the scene. And he saw his daddy's shoe. And he didn't realize that when he picked it up, it still had his daddy's flesh from his foot in the shoe. Of course, being an 8 or 9 year old boy, what did he do? He got back on his bike and he took it home to his mama. And of course, that experience, losing his daddy and seeing that, he has struggled, absolutely struggled with that all of his life to this day. It's caused him just great pain.
What was the outcome after Metcalf was injured so badly and Warless Jackson was killed? Did anyone ever pay a price for that?
No one was ever arrested in that case, even though the FBI had a good idea of who did it. And the prime suspect, without question, was a man named Red Glover. Glover himself had been in World War II. He had been in the Navy Seabees. He had actually had a shell explode and hurt his, I believe it was hurt his leg, and he would get this small $15 a month pension for that injury for the rest of his life. But he knew about explosives. And he had grown up with this real rabid hatred of black people. And when the civil rights laws, you know, hiring, putting black kids in schools with white kids, it was something that he simply could not conceive in his mind that that would, should even be allowed. He would, as a young man, he would go into bars, challenge people to fights. He was just a rough guy that Klansmen were afraid of. So consequently, what he had a very loose organization. They met at the Shamrock Motel in Vidalia. They would have coffee. They would talk about what they were going to do, but he let all of his people that he chose, they could act in groups of three or four on their own. They didn't need his permission to do anything. But the one thing that he expected of them is to keep their mouth shut. And if they didn't, he'd kill them. And there was not a member of the Silver Dollar group that didn't believe that he would do just that. And it's believed, many of the FBI agents I talked to, and I believe it too, that Glover alone slid under that truck that night and quickly wired those explosives to that left turning signal. Had Jackson not worked overtime, he would have been driving through that section of town, Minor Street, which is in the middle of a black neighborhood, at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon when it's a possibility children would have been outside playing. Because that he had to work overtime and the bomb didn't explode until late at night when it was raining, probably a lot of lives were saved.
You know, the documentary also discusses the obviously the large number of Klansmen who worked inside Armstrong Tire and Rubber Plant. And then after Warless Jackson was killed, they have video of the general manager standing before microphones, answering questions from reporters, and basically says he doesn't believe Warless Jackson was killed because of anything related to his job. And there just seemed to be a lot of denial about that. And frankly, the Armstrong general manager doesn't come off too well on this. He doesn't seem too sympathetic.
Yeah, I mean, it's always hard for me. Obviously, we can look back and see those things and how how wrong they look today, I always try to think of we're existing in the era in which we live, and we're trying to maybe do the best we can. So I don't know. We can be pretty harsh on those type of statements, or we can say, well, he was just trying to not make the Klan mad. Maybe they was going to kill somebody. I mean, you could speculate forever, but yes, it does not sound sympathetic whatsoever. And I think it's really important for people not to judge that case by today's standard. You have to take yourself back to those days and what was life was really like at that time. And also keep in mind, everybody was afraid of the Klan. Absolutely everybody, even Klansmen, were afraid of Red Glover and people like him in the Klan. So the fear within the community, black and white, was absolute. And it was this fear that made the FBI's job so hard. And it was a real fear.
Stanley, in the film, there's this moment where you bring the Wallace Jackson family to the Concordia Sentinel office and you want to talk with them and you've got something you need to pass on to them. What were you trying to convey to them?
Well, when they came to the office, you know, I mentioned earlier my experience with Rosa Williams, Frank Morris's granddaughter. And when she called me after that first article came out, she thanked me because she said that she had learned more from that one article than that she had known for all the years between the crime and that moment. And the fact that, as she explained to me, the FBI never talked to her. Nobody in law enforcement ever talked to her. She had no idea what happened. She had never seen an FBI document. She knew absolutely nothing. So it was my understanding that the Jackson family had not been visited by the FBI, an agent, to tell them what their investigation revealed. And so what I wanted to do, because they were interested in knowing this, I wanted to let them know what I had learned through both FBI documents that had never been released before and through my own interviews of people and with retired FBI agents to what all indications, what happened. They did not know that the prime suspect, the FBI suspect, was Red Glover. They didn't know that. They, you know, there were many, many things like that they had never been told. I knew that Red Glover was dead and most of the other suspects were dead. And so I just simply wanted to share with them what I knew, because that's the information that they have been waiting to hear. It's not satisfactory in that it provides justice, but it's a little bit of justice. And it you know, to know who the suspects were, what their Klan history was, what things they had said about Wallace Jackson, the plots with Metcalf and to kill Metcalf and the bombing experiments and all of these different things that were clearly in the record and clearly from interviews that I had done. Well, they didn't know that. No one had ever sat down and told them these things. And that's what I wanted to do. I didn't want to shock them. I didn't want to upset them. Wallace Jr. has such a hard time with this case, and I rarely have talked to him about it, that he didn't just become emotional and break down sometimes. Because when you talk to him and you look at his eyes, you see Wallace Jackson, that 8-year-old boy. You don't see that grown man. Just watch him on the show, and when he talks, just look at his eyes. It's a little boy talking, because he still lives in that time there. And his sister Denise and she is able to, she's dealt with it. She's come to terms with it. But I just wanted to share with them what I knew. And that's what I did.
Well, just so you'll know, and it's in this documentary, then and you may know this story, when it does show Wallace Jackson Jr. meeting with a fellow named Martinez Sutton, who's the brother of Rekia Boyd, a woman who was killed by Chicago police. And Wallace Jackson is like, you know, almost a priestly counselor.
And you're going to have some dark nights and dark days because of your sister's death, even as I have had with my father's death. And I want you to know, I want to be that person that you can call and talk to.
Hey, bro, feels good to hear that, man, because it's a lot of times where You just feel like you out here by yourself, all alone.
You have to do with some of it. We learn it in church or in synagogue or whatever, where we turn for our spiritual needs is that very simple thing, you know, treat people the way you want to be treated. Put yourself in their shoes. How would you feel if that was your father? I would feel exactly the same way, I have no doubt.
That was Stanley Nelson. In December 2021, he stepped down as editor of the Concordia Sentinel. He's teaching today at LSU. I want to tell you one more thing. In 2011, after plowing through thousands of pages of documents, interviewing scores of people, and writing more than 150 stories about murders that were more than four decades old, Stanley was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Local Reporting. He was cited for his courageous and determined efforts to unravel a long-forgotten Ku Klux Klan murder during the Civil Rights era. And I need to tell you that weekly newspapers rarely rank among Pulitzer Prize winners or finalists. In 2011, the year the Concordia Sentinel, with 5,000 circulation, was a finalist because of Stanley's work, the winner of the local reporting prize was the Chicago Sun-Times, with about 400,000 circulation. The Chicago Sun-Times team, I have to add, had more people working on their project than the three people Stanley Nelson had on his entire newsroom staff. Incidentally, he's written two books about all of this, Devil's Walking and Clan of Devils. We've been talking about Frontline and Retro Report's documentary, American Reckoning, which premieres Tuesday, February 15th at 10 Eastern Time on PBS and online at pbs.org/frontline, YouTube, and in the PBS video app. The project was supported by WNET's Chasing the Dream. Thanks again to the documentary's co-directors, Brad Lichtenstein and Yoruba Richin, and to Stanley Nelson, the reporter whose work made it all possible, and also to Anne Husted of Frontline for all of her help. I especially want to again thank my producer, Dave Barriswain. I'm Hank Klibanoff, and we'll be back soon with more. Buried Truths is a production of WABE Atlanta.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you donated to WABE yet? I know you've heard us talking about why it's important, but it doesn't have to be this big decision. You can give at whatever amount fits your budget. It can be a spur-of-the-moment thing. You already get so much out of public radio, so just go for it. Visit wabe.org/donate and become a member right now. And thank you.